Welcome back. Last time, we did a deep dive into data parallelism,
Right.
and we explored some cool optimization techniques like overlapping gradient synchronization and zero.
Yeah.
But what happens when your model is so massive
Yeah.
that even sharding parameters and gradients and optimizer states isn't enough?
That's when we step into the realm of tensor parallelism and context parallelism,
Okay.
techniques designed to handle the memory demands of truly gigantic models.
Okay, so before we jump into the new stuff,
Sure.
can you quickly remind us why data parallelism alone
Yeah.
isn't enough for these massive models? We talked about zero partitioning model data,
Okay.
but where do we still hit a bottleneck?
The bottleneck often lies in the activation memory.
Okay.
Activations, those intermediate results produced during the forward pass, can consume a significant amount of memory,
Right.
especially for large models and long sequences.
Uh-huh.
Even with zero, the sheer volume of activations can overwhelm a single GPU's memory capacity.
Right, those activations can be huge. So that's where tensor parallelism or TP sets in. It
Exactly.
sounds like TP takes sharding to a whole new level.
Yes.
Instead of just splitting model parameters and optimizer states like in zero,
Right.
it also tackles those memory-hungry activations.
Exactly. TP allows us to shard model parameters, gradients, optimizer states, and activations across multiple GPUs.
Okay.
Think of it like dividing a massive matrix multiplication problem among a team of workers.
Okay.
Each worker handles a portion of the matrix,
Uh-huh.
reducing the memory burden on any single worker.
So if I'm picturing this correctly with TP, I could train a model with, say, 70 billion parameters.
Yeah.
By distributing those parameters and their activations across multiple GPUs,
Yes.
is that the kind of memory saving we're talking about?
Absolutely. TP can drastically reduce the memory required per GPU,
Wow.
enabling the training of models that would be impossible to fit on a single device.
Yeah.
In the case of a 70B parameter model, TP can bring the memory requirement down to a manageable level for each GPU.
That's incredible. It seems like we're now able to scale model size without needing to scale up our hardware at the same rate.
Right.
Now I'm thinking about those transformer blocks, the
Yes.
workhorses of many of these large models. How does TP actually work within those blocks with their feed-forward and multi-head attention layers?
Good question. In the feed-forward layers, TP uses a combination of row-wise and column-wise sharding to distribute the workload across the GPUs.
Okay.
For example, the first linear layer might use column-wise sharding, where each GPU processes a subset of the columns of the weight matrix.
Okay.
The output is then broadcasted, and an all-reduce operation is used to combine the results from all GPUs.
Okay.
The second linear layer, often row linear, restores the full hidden dimension.
So we split the matrix, process it in parallel, and then combine the results.
Exactly.
What about the multi-head attention layers? How does TP handle the attention mechanisms?
For multi-head attention, each GPU can focus on a subset of the attention heads. It's like having a team of specialists, each handling a specific aspect of the attention mechanism.
Huh.
However, there's a constraint on the degree of TP we can apply here.
Okay.
The number of attention heads needs to be divisible by the number of GPUs participated in TP.
Okay, so there are limitations. And I'm guessing all this sharding and distributing comes with some communication overhead, right? We're moving data between GPUs all the time.
You're absolutely right. That's the trade-off with TP.
Okay.
While it reduces memory usage, it introduces communication requirements.
Uh-huh.
This overhead isn't too bad when communication happens within a node
Right.
using fast interconnects like NVLink.
Okay.
However, when we scale across multiple nodes and rely on slower network connections,
Yeah.
the communication overhead becomes more pronounced.
So finding the right balance between memory savings and communication overhead is crucial.
Yes.
It's not just about blindly maximizing parallelism. Now, we've talked about how TP helps us shard the matrix multiplications
Right.
in those attention and feed-forward layers. But what about operations like layer norm and dropout? They seem like they would need the full hidden dimension to work correctly.
You've hit upon another key aspect of model parallelism. Operations like layer norm and dropout do indeed require the full hidden dimension,
Okay.
and that's where sequence parallelism, or SP, comes into play.
SP. So it sounds like SP is designed to complement TP.
Yes.
Is it also a sharding technique?
It is, but instead of sharding across the hidden dimension, like TP-SP shards along the sequence dimension,
Okay.
this allows operations that need the full hidden dimension to operate on smaller chunks of the sequence.
Interesting. So we're strategically dividing the workload across both the hidden dimension and the sequence dimension to optimize memory usage.
Right.
Are there any special tricks involved in coordinating between these TP and SP regions?
Definitely. To manage the transitions between TP and SP regions, we use collective operations like all gather and reduce scatter.
Okay.
These operations ensure that the data is in the right place at the right time for each stage of the computation.
All gather and reduce scatter, those sound familiar from our deep dive on Zero.
Yes.
They're powerful tools for efficient distributed training, aren't they? Could you give us a quick refresher on how they work in this context?
Of course. Imagine you have a team working on a project, each member with a piece of the puzzle.
Okay.
All gather is like having everyone bring their pieces together so that everyone has the complete picture.
Right.
Reduce scatter, on the other hand, is like distributing the pieces back to the team.
Okay.
But this time, each member only receives the pieces relevant to their specific task.
Okay, that's a helpful way to visualize it. So all gather brings everything together, and reduce scatter distributes only the necessary information. Now, I'm curious about the communication overhead of SP compared to TP.
Yes.
It seems like SP would involve more communication with those additional all-gather and reduce-scatter operations.
It might seem that way, but SP actually has an equivalent communication volume to TP.
Oh?
It's just distributed differently.
So it's not about the amount of communication, but rather how it's managed. So with SP working alongside TP,
right,
we can push the boundaries of batch size and sequence length even further, without being crippled by communication costs.
Exactly.
But even with these techniques, I imagine there's a limit to how long our sequences can be before we run into trouble.
You're right. Even with TP and SP, extremely long sequences like those found in very large language models can still exceed the memory capacity of our distributed system.
Okay.
This is where context parallelism comes into play.
Context parallelism. Okay, this is where things get really interesting. We've sharded across the hidden dimension.
Yes.
We've sharded across the sequence dimension.
Right.
What else is there to shard?
With context parallelism, we take the bold step of splitting the input sequence itself across the entire model, including the attention blocks.
Whoa, we're splitting the sequence now.
Yes.
I'm already sensing some potential challenges, especially with the attention mechanism.
Right.
Which needs to consider relationships between tokens across the entire sequence.
Uh-huh.
How do we maintain that global view of the sequence when it's split across multiple GPUs?
You've identified the key challenge of context parallelism. While most modules like MLPs and layer norms handle this sequence splitting gracefully because they process each token independently,
okay,
attention requires special handling.
Uh-huh.
It needs to be aware of the entire sequence to compute those all-important relationships between tokens.
Okay.
This is where a technique called ring attention comes into the picture.
Ring attention. Okay, I'm intrigued. It sounds like it's going to involve some clever data passing between GPUs.
Exactly. Ring attention is designed to efficiently handle the communication of key-value pairs when the sequence is split across multiple GPUs.
Uh-huh.
Think of it like a relay race where each GPU passes information to the next in a ring-like pattern.
I'm picturing a circle of GPUs, each holding the piece of the sequence passing data around.
Yes.
So each GPU processes its chunk and then shares its results with its neighbor.
That's a good way to visualize it. It's like a carefully orchestrated dance of information exchange.
Okay.
Ensuring that each GPU has the information it needs to compute the attention scores for its portion of the sequence.
But wouldn't this kind of relay race create bottlenecks?
Yes.
Some GPUs might end up waiting for others to finish their computations before they can proceed.
You've highlighted a potential issue with a naive implementation of ring attention. Because of the way the causal attention mask works, some GPUs end up with a heavier computational workload than others,
right,
leading to imbalances and inefficiencies.
Ah, that makes sense. So how do we make this ring run smoothly and efficiently?
This is where a more sophisticated technique called zigzag ring attention comes in. It's like a smarter version of the relay race where the runners are strategically positioned to ensure a balanced workload.
Zigzag ring attention. I'm already liking the name. It sounds like it's going to involve some clever arrangement of the data.
Precisely. Instead of distributing the input tokens sequentially to the GPUs, zigzag ring attention mixes things up. It ensures that each GPU has a good mix of early and late tokens, balancing the computation and preventing those bottlenecks you mentioned.
So it's all about smart distribution. This must make a big difference in performance, right? By avoiding those bottlenecks, we can keep all the GPUs busy and avoid unnecessary waiting.
Absolutely. Zigzag ring attention leads to a much smoother and more efficient flow of information during the attention computation.
Okay.
But even with this technique, there are different ways to approach how we implement this communication and computation overlap.
So within zigzag ring attention, there are still choices to be made. I'm eager to hear about the different options and their trade-offs.
There are two main approaches, the all-gather implementation and the all-to-all or ring implementation.
Okay.
Both utilize the zigzag token distribution strategy, but differ in how they handle the communication of key-value pairs.
Okay, two flavors of zigzag ring attention. Let's break them down and see what makes them unique.
The all-gather implementation is like gathering all the puzzle pieces from everyone on the team at once.
Right.
It's simpler to implement.
Okay.
But it requires more temporary memory because each GPU needs to store all the key value pairs from all other GPUs.
So it's easier to manage, but comes with a higher memory cost. What about the all-to-all approach?
The all-to-all or ring implementation is like a well-coordinated exchange where each GPU only receives the specific pieces it needs from its neighbor in the ring.
Okay.
It's more memory efficient as each GPU only needs to store one additional chunk of data at a time.
So it's a bit more complex to coordinate, but gentler on our precious memory resources. It seems like the choice between these two implementations comes down to a trade-off between memory efficiency and implementation complexity.
Exactly. The best choice depends on the specific hardware constraints and the scale of the model we're dealing with.
This is fascinating. We've gone from sharding parameters and activations with TP and SP to splitting the sequence itself with context parallelism and these clever ring attention implementations. It's remarkable how each technique builds on the previous ones to address the challenges of training these massive models.
It truly showcases the ingenuity of the researchers in this field. They're constantly pushing the boundaries of what's possible, devising creative solutions to overcome limitations and enable us to train increasingly powerful AI models.
It's like an ongoing game of innovation leapfrog, with each new technique propelling us further into the realm of massive scale AI. Before we move on, I want to make sure I have a crystal clear understanding of how TP and SP work together. Could we walk through a specific example of how the activations change shape as they flow through a transformer block with both TP and SP applied? I think it would really solidify my understanding of this intricate dance of dimensions.
Absolutely. Let's take a transformer block with a hidden dimension of H and a sequence length of H as our example.
Okay, H for hidden dimension and H for sequence length. I'm ready to follow along.
Great. So when we enter the TP region, specifically the first linear layer, which is often collinear, the hidden dimension gets sharded. If we have two GPUs for TP, each GPU will process H2 of the hidden dimension. However, the sequence length remains untouched at this point. Each GPU sees the full sequence of H.
So we've sliced the hidden dimension in half, but the sequence length remains intact. Got it. What happens next?
The activation function, like GLU, is applied independently on each GPU. This doesn't change the shape of the activations. Then we move to the second linear layer, which is usually row linear. This layer restores the hidden dimension to its full size H. So after this layer, each GPU has activations of shape BXSXH, where B is the batch size.
Okay, so we split the hidden dimension, processed each part, and then brought it back together. So we're back to the full hidden dimension and the full sequence length.
Precisely. But remember, we're also applying SP, which shards along the sequence dimension. Before these activations move to the next SP region, we need to reduce scatter them. We reduce along the hidden dimension to ensure correctness with the row linear layer and scatter them along the sequence dimension.
So each GPU ends up with a chunk of the sequence, let's say S2, if we have two GPUs for SP, but with the full hidden dimension of H.
Exactly. Now these activations of shape BXS2XH enter the SP region. Here, operations like layer norm, which require the full hidden dimension, can be applied independently on each GPU to their respective portion of the sequence.
Wow, this is intricate. It's amazing how these techniques work together to optimize memory without messing up the computations. It's like a perfectly synchronized dance of data across these different dimensions.
That's a great way to put it. It's a testament to the cleverness of the algorithms and the careful engineering that goes into making these large-scale models trainable. Speaking of cleverness, remember how we talked about layer norm and TP training, not needing an all reduce for gradient synchronization?
Oh yeah, that was a pretty cool detail. Can you remind us why that is again?
It's because each TP rank sees the same activations after the all gather operation in the forward pass. This ensures that the layer norm weights stay synchronized naturally during the backward pass, eliminating the need for that explicit gradient synchronization step.
So layer norm gets a free pass. That's pretty neat. But what about dropout? Does it get the same special treatment in TP training?
Dropout, while less common in large language models these days, can still be relevant in some architectures. For dropout to work correctly in TP, we need to make sure that the random seed used for dropping out neurons is synchronized across all TP ranks. Otherwise, we'd end up with different neurons being dropped out on different GPUs, leading to inconsistencies and incorrect results.
That makes sense. We want to maintain deterministic behavior, even when we're splitting things up across multiple GPUs. It's amazing how much thought goes into making sure these techniques work correctly in a distributed setting.
It's a complex challenge, but it's essential to get these details right to ensure the reliability and accuracy of our models, especially at such a large scale.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground here. We've got tensor parallelism splitting things along the hidden dimension sequence, parallelism working its magic on the sequence dimension, and context parallelism taking the bold step of splitting the sequence itself. It's like a multidimensional game of Tetris optimizing memory usage at every turn.
I like that analogy. And just like in Tetris, we need to carefully consider the trade-offs involved. Each of these techniques comes with its own set of advantages and disadvantages.
Right. We talked about the communication overhead associated with TP, especially when scaling across multiple nodes. What are some other key trade-offs we need to keep in mind when choosing how to parallelize our training process?
One of the biggest trade-offs is between computational efficiency and memory availability. As we increase the degree of parallelism with TPSP or context parallelism, we generally reduce the memory requirements per GPU. But this often comes at the cost of reduced throughput, meaning it might take longer to train the model.
So it's a balancing act. We want to maximize memory efficiency to handle those massive models, but we also want to keep the training process as fast as possible. How do we decide where to strike that balance?
It's not always about maximizing parallelism. We need to consider the communication overhead, the characteristics of our hardware, and the specific requirements of our model. Sometimes it might even make sense to combine different parallelism techniques to strike the best balance.
So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's about carefully analyzing our resources and tailoring our parallelism strategy to achieve the best results. It sounds like there's quite an art to this. What tools or techniques can help us navigate these complex decisions?
You're right, there's definitely an art to it. Fortunately, there are tools and libraries like MegatronLM and DeepSpeed that provide the building blocks and the flexibility to experiment with different parallelism configurations. These tools allow us to find the optimal settings for our specific training setup.
It's like having a toolbox filled with powerful instruments, each designed for a specific purpose. We as AI practitioners need to become skilled artisans, understanding how to use these tools effectively to sculpt our training process. But before we get too carried away with the artistic side of things, let's come back to the practicalities of TP and SP. You mentioned a table earlier that summarized how the shape of the activations changes as they flow through a transformer block with both TP and NMV applied. I think revisiting that table would be really helpful for our listeners to solidify their understanding.
Absolutely. That table provides a handy reference for keeping track of how those dimensions are being manipulated at each stage of the conversation. Are you ready to dive back into the table?
Definitely. Let's break it down step by step and make sure we have a clear picture of how those dimensions are being sliced and diced.
Great. So let's start at the beginning with the embedding layer. In a standard setup, the embedding layer produces activations of shape, SBSXH, where B is the bat size, is the sequence link, and H is the hidden dimension. Now, with TP and SP in the mix, things get a bit more intricate.
Okay, I'm ready to follow along. What happens to those dimensions in the embedding layer when TP and SP are applied?
The embedding layer itself can be sharded using row-wise TP. This means that each GPU will process a portion of the vocabulary and produce a partial embedding matrix. To get the full embedding for each token, we would normally perform an all-gather operation. However, because we're also using SP, we use a reduced scatter operation instead.
So instead of gathering the full embedding matrix on each GPU, we're reducing it along the vocabulary dimension and then scattering it along the sequence dimension. It's like we're strategically distributing those embedding vectors right from the start.
Exactly. So after the embedding layer, each GPU ends up with activations of shep BXXH, where N is the number of GPUs. We've already split the sequence dimension in the embedding layer.
Okay, that makes sense. We're starting with a sharded representation of the sequence. What happens next as we move into the TP region, specifically the first linear layer, which you mentioned is often column linear?
Now, in the column linear layer, the hidden dimension H gets sharded, but the sequence dimensions remains intact. Let's say we have two GPUs for TP. Each GPU will process half of the hidden dimension H2, but still see the entire sequence length.
Got it. So we're slicing along the hidden dimension, but keeping the sequence length intact at this point. What happens in the next layer, the row linear layer?
In the row linear layer, we restore the hidden dimension to its full size. Each GPU now has activations of shape BXXXH. But remember, we're using SP, so we immediately perform a reduced scatter operation. We reduce along the hidden dimension, which ensures correctness with the row linear operation, and scatter the results along the sequence dimension.
So we're back to splitting the sequence dimension after briefly having the full hidden dimension available. It's like we're weaving these dimensions together, carefully managing where the splits occur to optimize memory usage.
Precisely. After the reduced scalar operation, each GPU holds activations of shape BXSXH. These activations are then fed into the SP region, where operations like layer norm, which require the full hidden dimension, can be applied independently on each GPU to their respective chunk of the sequence.
This entire process is like a meticulously choreographed dance of data. It's incredible how TP and SP work in harmony to manage memory while preserving the computational integrity of the body. It's clear that a lot of thought and ingenuity have gone into designing these techniques.
Absolutely. And as models continue to grow, these innovations in model parallelism will become even more crucial for pushing the boundaries of what's possible with AI. But before we wrap up our discussion of TP and SP, there's one more important aspect I'd like to touch on.
Okay, I'm all ears. What else do we need to know about this dynamic duo of TP and SP?
It's important to remember that the choice of how to split the hidden dimension and the sequence dimension with TP and SP depends on a variety of factors. The size of the model, the hardware we're using, and even the specific task we're trying to solve can all influence our decisions.
So there's no one-size-fits-all approach. It sounds like finding the right balance is key to maximizing performance.
Exactly. We need to consider the communication overhead, the memory capacity of our GPUs, and the computational efficiency of different splitting strategies. It's like finding the perfect recipe for our specific training scenario.
That makes perfect sense. It's not just about blindly maximizing parallelism. It's about carefully considering all the factors at play and tailoring our approach to achieve the best possible results. It sounds like there's a real art to finding that sweet spot where memory efficiency and computational speed and communication overhead all harmonize.
Right.
Now, shifting gears a bit.
Sure.
We've focused intensely on the training side of things.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the implications of these parallelism techniques for deploying these massive models for inference.
Right.
How do TPSP and context parallelism affect the process of actually using these models?
Yeah, good question.
In real-world applications.
That's a great point. Deployment is a crucial aspect of the AI lifecycle.
Right.
And these parallelism techniques can play a significant role in optimizing inference as well.
Okay.
While the specifics might differ from training,
the
core principles of splitting and distributing the workload can be applied to make these models run efficiently on various hardware platforms.
So could we use TP to split a model across multiple GPUs? Or even specialized AI accelerators?
Yes.
During inference. Would that help reduce latency and improve throughput, especially for applications where speed is critical?
Absolutely. For real-time applications like chatbots or language translation, where responsiveness is paramount,
right.
Using TP for inference can be incredibly beneficial.
Okay.
It allows us to leverage the parallel processing power of multiple devices to accelerate the inference process.
And with the rise of edge computing, where we're seeing AI models deployed on devices with limited resources,
right.
Techniques like TP and SP become even more important for enabling these powerful models to run efficiently on less powerful hardware.
Exactly. The ability to efficiently distribute a model across multiple devices or even partition it to run on a single device with limited memory is essential for bringing the power of these large models to a wider range of applications and platforms.
So it's not just about training these massive models, it's about making them accessible and usable.
Yes.
In a wide range of real-world scenarios, from powerful cloud servers to resource-constrained edge devices, that's really exciting.
It is.
It feels like we're opening up a whole new world of possibilities for AI applications.
I agree. And as hardware continues to evolve and new types of AI accelerators emerge, these parallelism techniques will become even more sophisticated and crucial for unlocking the full potential of these large-scale AI models.
It's amazing to see how these innovations are driving the progress of AI, both in terms of model capabilities and the breadth of applications. We've covered so much ground in this deep dive.
We have.
From the fundamentals of data parallelism to the intricacies of tensor parallelism, sequence parallelism, and context parallelism.
Yeah, it's been a great discussion.
It's been a whirlwind tour of cutting-edge techniques for training and deploying truly massive AI models.
It has been quite a journey. We've explored the challenges of scaling AI models to unprecedented sizes and the ingenious solutions that researchers and engineers have developed to overcome these obstacles.
And for our listeners, I hope this deep dive has provided valuable insights into the world of large-scale AI and the incredible innovation happening in this field.
I hope so too. These techniques are shaping the future of AI, enabling us to build and deploy ever more powerful and capable models that have the potential to revolutionize countless industries and aspects of our lives.
Well, on that note of anticipation for the future of AI, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise on these fascinating techniques.
It was my pleasure. It's always exciting to discuss these advancements and see the enthusiasm for pushing the boundaries of what's possible with AI.
And a huge thank you to all our listeners for joining us on this exploration of model parallelism. We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the fascinating world of AI.